Hello, film fans, and welcome to A Very Good Year, a new podcast where we invite a guest, a filmmaker or writer or actor or musician, anybody really who loves movies, to pick their favorite year of movies and to talk to us about that year. I'm Jason Bailey, and across the mic and across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
And our guest this week is one of my favorite writers and favorite people in the whole damn world, the TV critic for Vulture.com. Before that, her bylines appeared at Pajiba, the AV Club, RogerEbert.com, Polygon, and Crooked Marquee, where I just so happen to be editor-in-chief, among others. It is the one, the only, Roxana Haddadi. Hi, Roxana.
Hey, buddy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
You know, I mean, like, objectively terrible, but soldiering on, I guess.
There we have it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so excited to get to talk to you here because, you know, as I mentioned, you are a TV critic now.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the evil TV forces won the battle for your soul. It's a move I understand entirely because
sure.
As anyone who does this can tell you, there's way more work for TV critics than for film critics because there's way more TV and way more than film and also way more people who care about TV right now. But you're always, in my heart, a film person. And so I'm really glad we get to talk to you about movies tonight.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I love them both. I'm not going to say that I love more one, that I love one more than the other, necessarily. I'm also drinking, so that hopefully won't affect things too much.
Yay!
But, you know, the week started, so why not?
Why not?
Yeah. But yeah, I'm very excited about this. I love the idea of, like, an annual format, especially because there's some years that I think are amazing, as we'll discuss,
yep.
And some years that are just bad years.
Yeah, yeah.
So I like...
Hopefully those will come later in the run.
Yeah,
hopefully.
I like the idea that we're, you know, we're going to start off with a bang and we're going to start off with, like, in my opinion, one of the best recent years in film history. Yeah, let's say it. One of the best recent years in film history. I'm not going to back down from that.
Roxana hit me back with this one right away. There was no hesitation on what year she wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us your year of choice and kind of why this was the one you went with.
Oh, man. Yeah, I think I sent it to you within, like, I don't know, 5 seconds.
Yeah.
The year I went with was... 2007, the last hopeful year of America. You know, I was like, what was a simpler time? What was a simpler time?
Why was it the last hopeful year, Roxana?
You know, I think because we still, like, dared to believe that things could get better. We were like, okay, like, Bush mm-hmm. is here, but, like, you know, like, maybe he'll bounce out forever soon.
Yep.
And it was like, you know what, like... Obama's happening. That's, like, exciting, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
he was hopeful,
if memory serves. That was a hope.
Yeah, there was, like, a maybe something good could happen. And so I think that's where I was, like, mentally. And so I don't know mm-hmm. if that has put, like, a certain halcyon golden glow over these movies. But I have, like, very distinct memories of seeing these movies in the theater. And I was in college at the time. I was working at my college newspaper. And I remember watching the Oscars in the newsroom and, like, rooting for who I wanted to win. So I just have, like, a very distinct sense that, like, this year kicked ass. And then, like, as a separate conversation, it's like ever so often I'll be rewatching one of the movies that's on my top five because they are, like, amazing. And I will do the whole, like, look up what year it was. And then you string together all the other movies
right.
that came out that year. It's just like a crazy domino effect. And I feel like a good,
right.
like a good evidence for this is that when I put out on Twitter that we were, like, sort of working on something and I had, like, chosen mm-hmm. a year, I got an insane amount of replies and suggestions of people being like, here are my 6 favorite movies that came out that year or whatever. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if, like, just more things. Well, no, I do know. More things were getting funded that were not crap. You know, like, we hadn't fully slid over into crapitude. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, From a cinema history standpoint, the mm-hmm. thing that's sort of significant about this year to me is the fact that 2008 was the summer of this sort of triple play of The Dark Knight, mm-hmm. Iron Man 1, mm-hmm. Incredible Hulk. Like, it's very easy to make, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe sort of the scapegoat for all that is, you know, rotten about contemporary American movie making.
One or the other.
But, I mean, I think it is worth noting that, like, the year after this was the year that the paradigm shifted.
Right.
And to the extent that it is, you know, many of the movies in your top, God, almost all of the movies in your top five are studio pictures, mm-hmm. if not studio proper, then like their classics division.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to imagine any of these getting studio getting bankrolled or released by a studio in our, you know, it's the only 15 years later, but it's impossible to imagine these movies getting made on this scale in our current moment, mm-hmm. just because these are not the kind of movies that get made anymore.
No. Well, these movies would get made, but like a fraction of this idea would get made by Netflix for like, I don't know, a pittance, and like nobody would watch it. It would just be. So 2007, the last good year, 2008, the first bad year. I think we should just say it, and you know, let's stick with that. I'm good with that.
Yeah. And then the only other thing I will add is that on a personal note, because it does become personal when these are recent years.
Of course.
2007 was my first full year living in New York City. So it was like, first of all, a huge part of moving to New York for me was getting to see the movies when they came out. Like
the
getting
movies.
The Entertainment Weekly.
You're seeing the movies.
I'm seeing the moving pictures. But getting the Entertainment Weekly fall preview and being like, I can see that on that day.
Right.
As opposed to living in Wichita, Kansas, where I'd spent my first 30 years, where it was like, maybe we'll get it in 3 months. Maybe I'll see it on VHS in 8 months. Who knows?
Yeah.
So when in 07, it was the first full year, my wife was going to school during the day. I was working in news at night.
Mm-hmm.
And at least once a week, I went to the AMC in Times Square, the AMC in Lincoln Center, the AMC at 34th, or the Landmark Sunshine downtown. Went to the first movie of the day, the 10 a.m., paid the discount matinee price, and spent the rest of the day sneaking into, like, you know, two or three other movies.
Of course.
So I saw, like when I was making the list of sort of everything that came out, I was shocked by how many movies like that I saw theatrically and that I have never thought of again.
Oh,
like ever.
Oh, wow.
You know, just because I saw everything. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get to your top five here mm-hmm. in just a moment. Before we do, I have asked our esteemed colleague, Mr. Hull, to gather some of the news headlines of 2007 to give us some idea of what was happening in the world outside the movie theater
mm-hmm.
At the time in which we're discussing. So, Mike, take it away.
Well, this was 15 years ago, which can both feel like forever and also 2 weeks. Especially in sort of COVID, you know, the way COVID has sort of altered time, you know. And as Roxana very astutely mentioned at the beginning, what was already in our head was George Bush, was everybody was mad at Dick Cheney. Donald mm-hmm. Rumsfeld was just sort of on his way out. It was clear that Iraq was a complete disaster and mess. You know, a lot of the things that activists were warning us about in 2003 had obviously become true. There were no WMDs. We were not welcome as liberators, and people were upset about it. It was a huge topic of conversation. And, you know, one of the things we forget about now is that one of the front runners for the 2008 election was Jeb. Remember Jeb? And we were talking about like this idea of like a Bush dynasty and sort of, you know, and nobody wanted that. And he was like the nice one. So he was going to trick everybody into thinking that nothing was happening, playing that like, aw shucks shit like his dad did. You know, like this was a big part of the conversation. And then along comes Barack Obama. And, you know, he seemed so different, was a constitutional scholar. So there was a lot of that kind of stuff happening in the world. You know, things sort of felt hopeful in a way that turned out to be complete bullshit, and none of it was justified, and he was totally overwhelmed, and nobody saw Mitch McConnell coming. The Virginia Tech shooting was that year, you know, there were a lot of like, you know, big bombings in Iraq that were happening that year. So there was a, you know, even with all of this sort of negative things happening, I think it's true that there was a feeling that we were coming out of it, but there was also a real feeling of sort of trying to figure out what happened. The housing crisis was going on. You know, there was, I think there was a real sort of sense, not just of hope, but also of trying to sort of figure out how the hell we got here. And I think that that's another thing that we've kind of lost as a national culture now, that it's important to sort of remember then that there were a lot of, I think a little bit more of a sense of like what happened and how to keep it from happening again. Not that that came to anything. It was just a feeling in the air.
But man, whew, it took me back. Rumsfeld. Talk about a name I never want to hear again for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Shout out to the war criminals of 2007 who got away with literally everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to note that and this is not accidental. These things do not happen coincidentally. There was something in the air circa 05, 06 when these films of 07 are being made that are so many of them in your top five and some of the ones we'll talk about elsewhere that really are about grappling with the American experiment and with where we are as a people and as a culture and a kind of overwhelming, overriding bleakness that was the sort of psychological remnant of the Bush years. So that said, let's get to your top five. High five! Roxana, walk us through, if you will, your top five movies of the year of our Lord 2007.
Okay. Well, you know, what I emailed you back with, like, literally as soon as I sent you this list, because you were like, please send us your list. And I was like, bet, like, here it is immediately. I also sent you, like, a follow-up that was like, this list will further cement me as the film bro that we all know. That I am.
Some of them, yes. Yeah. When we get to it, I will note there is one title in particular that I do not believe was on a lot of dorm room walls.
Yeah.
But yes, there's, you know, that's also, again, that's kind of what was in the air.
Yeah,
at the
that's
moment.
Fine. You know, I've also been called a Bernie bro, so like I'm just gonna embrace all of it as an Iranian.
The bro-acity.
Yeah, as an Iranian American woman. Okay, so let's do my top five. My top five in alphabetical order. Because I couldn't choose. They're all my babies. Like, I couldn't, like, rank them. Okay. Eastern Promises.
You want to go for a drink?
It's Christmas. Everything's closed.
Sometimes, if things are closed, you just open them up.
This girl ended up in the hands of the Vorifa Sekonyi. Do you know what that means?
How did you get in here?
They are always open doors.
He wants the diary.
My son, Kirillos. Mentioned many a times.
I think he was threatening to harm the baby.
If the diary should find its way to the police.
Okay, boss, you don't have to worry. Police won't find anything.
She was 14, just a child.
Forget any of this ever happened. Stay away from people like me.
David Cronenberg and Viggo Mortensen's reunion after A History of Violence a couple of years earlier. What do you love so much about Eastern Promises?
God. There's so many things to say. I think probably the first thing I will say is that, like, you know this about me, and it comes up with another movie on this list. I'm always very interested, as a child of immigrants, about culture clash type of stories, like relocation types of stories, like what happens when you are taken from a place that you knew to a place that you don't know, what changes about you, how do you change the place you're in, all of that sort of jazz. And I think, much like how The Godfather as a gangster movie is really like a family legacy dislocation movie, Eastern Promises is a family legacy dislocation movie. So I think all of that sort of like core DNA is there, and I love that shit. Like, that is just like, you know, it's the stuff that makes me cry. It's the stuff that makes me emotionally invested. Yeah. It's great. So in terms of that like basic narrative, I'm 100% down. I'm also very in love with Viggo's performance in this. Because honestly, yeah. I don't really like History of Violence. Like, I there's something about it that did not necessarily click for me.
Same.
But, like, Viggo here is just so scary, but, like, so attractive and compelling. And you cannot... You can't look away from Viggo. Like, Viggo in this movie is just everything. He is so in control and so precise of everything that he is doing, and he does so much with seemingly nothing. I was on another podcast recently talking about Ryan Gosling and how, like, he has perfected stillness. And I think Viggo does, like, a version of that. Like, I'm thinking about, like, the tattoo assessment scene where he is just sitting still and these other, like, higher-up gangsters are looking over his body and, like, reading his story through these tattoos. And you understand what Viggo is going through in that moment, like, the bareness and rawness of it. But I think he has, like, one facial expression in this entire scene. So I just think it's, like, a very interesting study in terms of contrasts of, like, this very emphasized violence that is happening within this community that we know about, like throat slit assassinations, 15-year-old girls being sex trafficked, like all this incredibly awful stuff. And then sort of the like tempering, well, we're going to shoot this movie with like very specific production design and this sense of we're letting you into secret places and you're seeing something you shouldn't see. So I think it does such a good job of like making us feel what Naomi Watts is feeling and experiencing. And I will say like the last thing that I'll say is like I already am like very emotional. I'm like a very emotional person. So like I love movies for like making me feel big emotions. But I think, like, this movie, there are certain scenes that, like, my partner will just, like, say a line to me, and I'm like, well, there goes the rest of the day, man. Like, it is just enveloping and great. And I love it. I love it very much. It's probably my favorite Viggo. Yeah. It's my favorite Viggo.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
No, and your point about the culture clash, I think, is really interesting, because it is tempting to compare these two pictures, to compare this with A History of Violence.
Yeah.
I've always preferred this one as well, and I've never really been sure why, but I think what you're saying is certainly an advantage, whereas there's a very sense, you know, A History of Violence is very much a sort of an American movie about small town values and all that sort of stuff. But the culture clash of this film, I think, is much richer, fertile soil for this filmmaker and for this actor to explore. Roxana, what is the number four movie on your non-ranked list of the best movies of 2007?
Okay, the number four movie, which I potentially already spoiled by saying half of it, is Michael Clayton.
All right. I'm going to make it easy. Let's make it five. Five, and I'll forget about Arthur.
Five is easier. Yeah, five is something we could talk about.
Good. And then the other five is to forget about the 468 people that you knocked off with your weed killer.
Let me finish up this meeting. I'll talk to
Don. Do I look like I'm negotiating?
One of the greatest cinematic fuck yous. I love it so much. I miss this type of George Clooney so much.
Yeah.
This kind of like incredibly in control, but also desperate man. Like, man, Clooney is like amazing at that kind of shit. And I miss Tony Gilroy when he made these kind of movies and he wasn't stuck in Star Wars hell. When we're talking about like what's changed in the 15 years since 2007, that's the stuff that's changed. Like, who knows what else Gilroy would have made if he wasn't like stuck. But again, like, this movie so much captures to me this time and sort of the shifting tide of like, we know how evil corporations can be and we know how much they don't care about us, and what can we possibly communicate that as an act of revolt and an act of like radicalism. And like, I don't really care that it's a, you know what I mean, it's like I feel like somebody could very well say like, well, can that messaging come from a studio movie? I think it's rare. But I think Michael Clayton really does it. And I also think that, again, in terms of just how this movie looks, how this movie fucking looks, man. Like, the opening with the scene and the horses the bartering in this restaurant as Clooney's character sees like so much more of his money just walk out the door.
Just set on fire.
Set on fire. And of course, I mean, like, how do you even talk about this movie without talking about the final altercation?
Oh, yeah.
And the final shot of Clooney in the car, this uninterrupted moment that so many movies have copied, so many TV shows have copied.
Yeah.
And like, no one has come close to how powerful it is. And I've said this on Twitter before, and I'll stand by it, that like, I don't think Clooney has ever had a better line delivery than, you know, does it look like I'm fucking negotiating? You know what I mean? That's it. The pinnacle.
That's what that guy can do. Yeah.
That's it. It's not going to get better than that.
Yeah.
So I love Michael Clayton. I wish that more people had watched Dark Waters, which feels like its more present day counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, like Michael Clayton, Aaron Brockovich, those kind of like, we're going to stick it to people and we're going to stick it to the people who are hurting us. I love that shit. And this is like
the top
movie in that subgenre.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting is I remember it coming out and it getting like kind of a respectful, but sort of muted reception.
Mm-hmm.
It made some money, but it wasn't a big hit. It was nominated for a lot of Oscars, but it only won, I believe, like the one for Tilda Swinton. But I feel like it's a movie that has really like grown in sort of regard and esteem and power that, you know, I revisited it the other night. Just because I hadn't seen it in so long and I wanted I wanted an excuse to watch it again, to be real honest, which this, you know, this podcast, as Mike has mentioned, will give us a lot of excuses to watch and rewatch things.
Yeah.
But it really was like, I had about an hour before I was gonna go to bed and I was like, I'll just put this on while I'm doing some stuff. And, you know, and I tweeted about this apparently very common experience of being like, I'm going to put this on for a minute. And then you're just like, you're in until he's driving away.
Yeah. You cannot stop watching it. It is what it is. It's sort of the same thing for me with like Syriana. It's like, I can't just randomly put on Syriana or any of the Oceans movies.
Well, yeah.
Or potentially anything else George Clooney has been in. Well, that's a lie. Monuments Men, I could like ignore Monuments Men. Like,
No, there's plenty to skip.
Yeah.
Roxanna, your number three selection in your non-ranked list of the best five films of the year 2007.
Jason, I don't even really know if I can like make it through talking about this movie, to be perfectly honest with you. But my number three selection is Mira Nair's The Namesake.
Baba, is that what you think of when you think of me? Do I remind you of that night?
Not at all. You remind me of everything that followed. Every day since then has been a gift.
Which is a movie that I don't understand how it doesn't have more love and more admiration.
It's been kind of memory-holed in a very weird way.
I really don't get it. Never got a Blu-ray release. Just like has disappeared into the ether. But I, you know what? I think it's Nair's best movie. I think it's one of our... Yeah, you know what? Yeah, fuck it. I'm going to put it above Mississippi Masala. Fuck it. I don't care. Yes.
I was going to say, I just saw that one for the first time about a month ago, and that's a bold statement.
Yeah.
That's bold.
You know what? I'm saying it. And I, you know, I don't know. I don't know what I can say about this movie that I haven't already said. I mean, I think the source material is beautiful. The novel by Jhumpa Lahiri is just staggeringly gorgeous, again, in terms of like a dissection of culture. How where you come from makes you who you are, or the inverse, how separate your identity can be from your source culture, what sort of choices go into that. Kalpend, of course, is always going to be remembered for being a comedic actor, but I think his work in this movie is
beautiful,
really beautiful and really thoughtful.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I lost my dad last year. And this movie had already, before that happened, really made me assess my relationships with my parents.
Sure.
And Irfan Khan's work is just...
Ugh.
I don't know. Like, transcendent.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
you know, just like it cuts through you. There is this scene where he and Cal Penn are in a car and Irfan Khan's character is finally explaining to his son the nickname that he chose for his son and sort of why that is important. And there's so much there about like what your parents don't tell you and like what you miss out on. And then eventually what you come to discover as you become an adult. I don't know, man. I feel like this is one that like everybody should watch. What's so funny too is like, I think a few years ago we had this like discourse where it was like, I mean, we have it every few years, but there was like the women directors discourse, Greta Gerwig discourse. And it's like, man, Mira Nair has been making movies for like 40 fucking years and you guys don't respect or appreciate her enough. And if you need to start, start with the namesake.
Yeah. 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 I've nothing to add to that. It's just, it's really gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And her, I feel like my hope is that the extent to which people have sort of discovered Mississippi Masala because of that beautiful Criterion release will push some people in the direction of some of her other work, because she, there's not a bad one in the bunch. You know, all of them have something compelling, something in them to recommend, something unique that's that that works. All right. Your number two on your non-ranked list of the best films of 2007, Roxana, is?
Jason, once again, what could I potentially, what could I possibly even add to the discourse around There Will Be Blood?
If you have a milkshake, and I have a milkshake, and I have a straw, there it is, that's a straw, you see. Watching. And my straw reaches across the room and starts to drink your milkshake. I drink your milkshake. I drink it up.
What could I what could I even say? There's nothing to say. There's nothing to say. No, actually, you know what? Fuck it. I will say this. My the drink is like halfway gone. My frustration in this, the year of whatever, Lord or not Lord, 2022, is I don't understand why we're still having a conversation about like movies for boys and movies for girls.
Right.
Like,
right.
It's exhausting. Destroy, destroy the gender binary. Everybody is here for There Will Be Blood. This movie is for everyone. And I'm very tired by the like only film bros like Scorsese and There Will Be Blood argument. I don't think, I mean, there are probably movies that talk about like American capitalism and greed in a better way. None are coming to me right now, aside from There Will Be Blood. And I just think that it is magnificent. I think DDL is great. I don't think PTA has made a better movie. And Licorice Pizza was really bad. So those are my thoughts on There Will Be Blood.
We're gonna glide past that last point. I will say this. This is one that took me, I think, three times.
Oh my God.
To really, really tune in on. Well, I mean, again, we have to, you know, we're talking about context. We're talking about seeing the movie in the moment.
Yes.
You know? And the thing that you know, younger viewers or people who came to PTA late have to keep in mind is there is this very pronounced arc to this career in terms of style and voice and tone, you know, and I fell in love with the PTA of Boogie Nights and Magnolia.
A very different PTA.
We saw a bit of, you know, sort of a hinge with Punch Drunk Love, but you know, I kept waiting and, you know, There Will Be Blood. So much of it is on a slow boil.
Yeah.
Whereas the early films are just like an explosion every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I kept waiting for the explosions in this movie. And when they didn't come, it felt weirdly not up to snuff.
Mm-hmm.
It took a couple of viewings and also sort of seeing the films that came after to really firmly appreciate what he's doing in this, which is a very different thing. That's much harder than explosions every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But also like that, is the evolution of an artist. And like, that's a beautiful thing. You know, I've never heard it put better, and I wish I remember who said it, than the person on Twitter who divided the PTA filmography into the two periods of Coke Kid and Weed Dad.
I remember that.
But this is the beginning of Weed Dad, and I think it's, you know, it's but yeah, it's a big, bold, beautiful, significant work of art, and it's rich in a way that's sort of staggering.
Yeah.
Like every time I go back to it, I'm seeing stylistic things that sort of crept up that I didn't notice. I'm more aware of a great performance than I might have been before. It's a movie that keeps giving.
Mm-hmm. Especially because I don't think that we necessarily appreciated everything that Paul Dano was doing at the time, because like DDL was so gargantuan in this.
So
I feel like sort of the Paul Dano performance sort of fell a little bit by the wayside. But like, my God, talk about like keeping your own with DDL. Like, I, you know, that is a true like two-hander. And I guess my frustration with some of DDL's later stuff is I feel like There Will Be Blood was very tangibly about something. And I think my frustration is feeling like Inherent Vice or like Licorice Pizza are not necessarily about things I care about nearly as much.
That's fair.
So
that's fair.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Should we talk about the last one?
We're down to our last. Inescapable. Anyone who knows 2007 can take a real solid guess here.
Yeah. Like, I don't even, you know, like, it's just, it's only like my top comfort movie in like a very bizarre way. It truly is a movie that sometimes at like 11 p.m. I'm like, you know what? I want to go to bed. Like, let me just like hop on and put on Zodiac and like see how much of it I can watch before I, you know, fall asleep.
Yeah.
Zodiac was my job. It's not yours.
He's still out there, Dave.
Killing is his compulsion. It drives him. It's in his blood.
Jeez.
What?
Squirrels.
This is the Zodiac speaking.
I have a gun.
I can give you a lift to the service station.
Do you always go around helping people in the night?
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Again, like, to me, like, Fincher at, like, the height of his powers, man. Like, this is a staggeringly detailed portrait of a time and a place coming together to just communicate dread, overwhelming, infectious dread. And I just think that it is so cold in a way that I find really reassuring. It sort of reminds me that, like, I don't really matter, and to someone else, I'm just meat, and I don't know. There's something sort of humbling about that I appreciate.
Well, it's been noted before. I'm not, you know, breaking any intellectual ground here, but you know what I think is fascinating is we don't think of Fincher as a personal director. We don't think of him as someone who's trafficking in autobiography. You know, he's a stylist first and foremost, and a brilliant one. And this is it's my favorite Fincher film, but I also think it's his best film formally. Some of the things that he's doing just in terms of, you know, composition and cinematography and editing pace are just unmatchable. But I also think that it's a very personal film for him thematically, because he has this notorious, sometimes earned, sometimes overblown reputation as a perfectionist.
Yeah.
And you hear this, and this was, I think, one of the first movies where we really started hearing those stories, because he had gone digital. So there were all of these stories about him doing like 40 takes and then just like wiping them off the card. And Gyllenhaal talking about like just like his feeling his spirit like crushed in that moment.
Just demoralizing as hell. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, but he has this reputation of perfectionism and like you mentioned, you know, meticulous attention to detail and so forth. And this is a film about how you can have all of those qualities and still not solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Still not solve the mystery, you know, but really, like, I've heard him and a lot of sort of his contemporaries, people like Soderbergh, talk about making a movie as like a series of solving problems.
Mm-hmm.
And here, you know, is this story about, you know, people who follow every clue, who have everything lined, who should be able to solve this thing and just can't.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to, and to walk away at the end of a movie that's a 2.5 hour true crime movie and say, we don't really know who did it.
We have no idea.
And the audience to just kind of go along with that,
yeah,
like, is astonishing to me. To have the stones to try that and then to get away with it is amazing. Yeah.
The last thing that I'll say too is that, like, on the flip side of that, it is about being really, really good at something that is fucking awful. It is,
yes,
also about being really good at being a serial killer, because, like,
yes,
those restagings are horrifying, but also,
yeah,
in an incredibly awful way, somewhat respectable, because it's like, oh dear God, mm-hmm, like, you planned this out in every way that someone can plan something out, and, like, you did outsmart us, you did somehow get away,
yeah,
with something abysmal and, like, soul-crushing. Wow. And Fincher, like, thrives on that shit, right? Like, he thrives on procedure,
right,
no matter morality. And that's just, I, you know what? I, it's my before bed movie. I don't know what to say.
Roxana, it's a hell of a year and it's a hell of a top five. And to revisit, the top five is Eastern Promises, Michael Clayton, The Namesake, There Will Be Blood, and Zodiac.
Mm-hmm.
And on that note, let's do some awards and box office.
Sell out with me, oh yeah, sell out with me tonight.
Mike is going to walk us through some of that year's Oscar winners, some of its other significant award winners, and the movies that made a lot of money. And we will briefly discuss those that did not come up in your top five, which is most of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Here we go.
The answer is just No Country. Let's move on. Best Picture, Best Director for Joel Cohen, and what else? Javier Bardem got Supporting Actor and Adapted Screenplay for the Coen Brothers. All went to No Country for Old Men, a very boring movie.
Whoa! Okay, Roxana, where do you land on No Country for Old Men?
I think No Country is good to, mm-hmm, very good. I mm-hmm, you know, it's sad.
It's a good adaptation of a guy who writes things that aren't supposed to be, like, easy to consume. His books are,
I think
his
that's
books
a very
are
good
fucking
point.
A slog, and it's not because they're not well written. It's because he's a he feels horrible about existence on the inside, and he wants you to feel that way when you consume his art. He wants it to be as hard as possible for you to consume, and in order to translate that correctly, which is something those guys make, they're good movie, they're good filmmakers,
right?
They're good adapters. Like, they do they did a good job of adapting something that never should have been written in the fucking first place. Okay.
Okay. Wait. I will say, to interrupt that, do you prefer The Road to No Country, or are you like a
no?
Okay.
No,
I love The Road.
No,
oh,
it's the only thing worse. No, it's very. That's the thing. It's very, very well done. But what about you needs to consume that vision of humanity?
See, I think, like, but I think The Road accomplishes what Cormac wants you to think, right? Like, I think The Road is like, This shit can't be redeemed, and, like, there's no, like, reconciling that. Like, we at our core are unnecessary. And I think The Road makes that point way better than No Country. I don't think anybody remembers that No Country ends with Anton just, like, walking away. You know what I mean?
And, like, I prefer to have those thoughts alone by myself in the dark in the last 2 minutes before I fall asleep.
Okay.
Like, exploring it sort of outside of that reality is, to me, seems like an unnecessarily masochistic form of self-abuse.
Okay.
Roxana,
like,
I like
when the sun is up, you want to watch this movie?
Jason knows. That's the shit I want. I'm like, show me how bad we are in broad fucking
daylight.
Well,
no. You know, and if we want to talk about sort of corollaries to what's happening in the world, like the idea of him walking off unpunished at the end of that movie, in a movie that came right at the end of the Bush era, is pretty fucking bang on. Let's keep moving through the Oscar winners, Mike.
Yes, best actress Marion Cotillard for La Vie en Rose.
Mm-hmm.
Supporting actress the aforementioned Tilda Swinton
in
Michael Clayton. Best original screenplay, Diablo Cody for Juno. You remember that? Talk about hopeful. Like, I feel like that was like going to be a whole new like career and style of taking young women's feelings seriously. And then
no, please come on. No, our feelings don't matter.
Where do you land on Juno? Where do you go on that? Where do you land on that?
I remember being initially very impressed by Juno and then almost immediately being like, fuck this movie. And I, and I don't know why that transition occurred.
The two genders.
Yeah. I don't quite remember what the change was. I think there was just something, I think Diablo Cody just like really annoys me. And I think I was just annoyed by like her press tour. So I probably should actually revisit the movie. But like,
I think what probably happened was like the 40th time you heard she was a stripper for like 2 weeks. Yeah. You were like, all right, fucking enough already.
I think I was annoyed by that. And I also think I was just like, she could have gotten an abortion. Like I think, and especially like now, I feel like it's like, but she could have gotten an abortion. So, yeah.
Would have been a much shorter picture is the problem with that.
That's not necessarily true. The movie Saint Francis, which you know I love very much,
very good.
also features a woman who gets an abortion, and then there's like a whole rest of a movie reconciling with her feelings about that. So I do think that there is space for those stories as well. It does not just have to be that like Jennifer Garner appears and like is the perfect white woman to adopt your baby.
Right.
Right. But okay, anyway, moving on from Diablo.
We'll adopt your baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some other things, significant award winners from that year. Atonement won the Golden Globe for Best Picture.
Good for Atonement.
And Atonement won the BAFTA also.
You like Atonement?
Me? Yes, I do like Atonement. Yes, I do.
I have come around on that one as I've learned to love Joe Wright more. I was initially just extremely annoyed by it because I felt insulted as a viewer that they felt the only way I could know that a character was the same person when she was an adult was by giving her the same haircut she had when she was 12. That's the tiniest detail, but I found it extremely,
Jason,
extremely annoying.
Four seasons of Stranger Things have relied on you identifying characters by their bad haircuts. So who are we to judge, you know?
Indeed. Indeed.
Diving Bell and the Butterfly won Golden Globe for Best Foreign Language and Best Director for Julian Schnabel. Also won the BAFTA for Adapted Screenplay.
Yeah, his best to date, in my opinion.
And a movie I haven't thought about in a really long time. So
good movie, though.
Yeah, my niece.
I'm Not There won Golden Globe for Supporting Actress. And Sweeney Todd won the Golden Globe for Best Picture and Best Actor for Johnny Depp. Again, remember those days.
No, I don't want to.
It should,
no.
Should be noted that is the Globe's weird, you know, split off between musical or comedy.
Yeah.
So a lot of times we have, it's sort of the default that there was a musical that year, so it won those Golden Globes.
Right.
None of that, however, is represented in the box office, which was dominated by Spider-Man 3, $336 million, Shrek 3, $322 million.
Excuse me, Shrek the Third. Yeah. Show some respect.
I hate you, Jason. I hate you so much.
I don't have to respect those corporate. Transformers won $319 million.
Wow.
No respect.
Wow. You know what's so funny?
I have
funny?
Such a...
Did I literally think 2007 was the last good year, and now you're just listing... you're listing franchises that I'm like, dear God. Like,
oh, we're not even close to done.
It doesn't get better for a minute. Hang on.
Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, whichever number that was, is $309 million.
You know what? I will say that at World's End was sort of good. Wasn't that the one where Kira... Kira becomes like a pirate.
Know.
Okay, I think that's the one where Kira becomes a pirate captain, and it was like sort
I'll believe
of good.
You.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm sorry.
Harry
Potter.
I'll believe you both that that happens and that it's sort of good. I'll
oh
believe
my God.
You on both points.
Pirates of the Caribbean followed by Harry Potter. It's just like the worst.
Followed by Harry Potter, whatever number that was. The Phoenix one for $292 million.
Wow.
Luckily, people don't insist that I take those that series seriously anymore. So that's been a really nice thing that the lady has done for me on Twitter.
It gave us Daniel Radcliffe and it gave us Emma Watson, and those things are good.
And wait, he was in Equus. That didn't that make his name? No? All
right. It also gave us Robert Pattinson. Shout out to Robert Pattinson. He's listening.
His weird ass. Good for him.
He's listening.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Bourne Ultimatum was number 6 with 227.
Good
million.
Movie. Good movie.
300. Mulan Labe was number 7 with 210. Yeah, some real solid history in that one. Ratatouille, also basically history by the standards of 300. 206 million.
Charming.
Charming
picture.
Charming.
I Am Legend at number 9 with 199.
Tolerable.
And The Simpsons Movie with 183. Remember the pig walking on the ceiling?
Oh,
you remember those days.
Good stuff.
Do you remember when
good
they
stuff.
Made the 7-Elevens look like Quickie Marts? That was like a college.
Do I? Do I?
Yeah.
Yes.
We,
it
like,
was right down the street
one.
From the theater
yeah,
where I saw it.
Yeah. Okay, wait, should I mention my honorable mentions that did not make any money?
Oh yeah. Well, no, I think they're I put them at the top of the lightning round.
Okay, cool. Good.
Okay, so which so, there we go. That's the transition.
That's it.
Lightning
We're
round
there.
Time.
We're there.
Here's how it works. Mike is going to put 15 minutes on the big clock.
Okay.
I have a list of so many other 2007 movies.
Okay.
We're gonna bang through them.
Okay.
You give me your quick hit summary.
Okay.
Good, bad, indifferent. What you liked, what you didn't. If you didn't see it, just pass and we move on.
Okay.
And we'll see what we can do in 15. You ready?
Yes, let's do it.
Here we go. The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford.
Perfect. Flawless. It's unfortunate that Casey and Brad are in it, knowing now what we know about them. But if Andrew Dominik ever gets like a trilogy American mythology release, I want to write one of those essays. So A plus work.
Yeah, same. All I will add to that is that, like, in an incredible and impressive career, I think it's Roger Deakins' most beautiful
Oh
movie.
My God. The
it's
train. The train.
Gorgeous.
Like, how do you even.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Sunshine.
Oh my God.
By director Danny Boyle.
Sunshine. Possibly Danny Boyle's last good movie. I mean.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, let's just say it up front. Astonishing, astonishing ensemble. Like, you got Mark Strong, you got Killian, you got Michelle. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got everybody in that movie. That movie also A+. No notes. Zero notes. You know what? Pinbacker is an exceptional sci-fi villain. And the people who were like, oh, Sunshine was good until it became a horror movie. Losers. Losers.
Losers.
Losers.
Loser people. They don't deserve the third act of Sunshine.
Loser behavior.
Gone Baby Gone from director Ben Affleck.
Gone Baby Gone. Also good. My favorite Ben Affleck directed movie. We really, this was like a moment for Casey, huh? Like 2007
mm-hmm.
was like his time.
That fall. I mean, like those two came out like within about a month of each other.
Wow.
That fall.
Yeah. Gone Baby Gone. Good.
Amy Ryan. Mwah.
Good. Yes. Good.
American Gangster from Ridley Scott.
American Gangster. Fine. Not my favorite. But fine. I mean, I think it's like, it might be one of Scott's like most predictable. Like, I don't necessarily think he does anything like different or unique with this material.
Mm-hmm.
But like, mm-hmm. the performances were good. Like, Ridley's never exactly bad unless he's like, you know, making Exodus and like talking about Muhammad so-and-so. So.
Yeah. I think a kind of underrated Denzel performance in American Gangster.
100%.
It's so much fun when he's playing bad.
Yeah.
Once. Remember Once?
I barely remember Once. I mean, I think it was fine. I don't remember like being like, fuck this movie. But I also remember just being like, oh, they fall in love. That's nice. You know, like whatever. It was fine. They broke up, right? Like, I'm sorry that happened to them. So,
sorry to this man.
Yeah, I'm
that
sorry.
He lost this woman.
I'm sorry.
Southland Tales.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Southland Tales. God, I don't even know what to say. All I would say is that like both like the most correct and the most annoying men on Twitter stand for this movie. And like, I'm glad that there is a unifier between like the men I despise and the men I love. There is a, I don't know when this is going to come out. If it comes out in July, Southland Tales is part of the Arrow Video 50% off sale at Barnes and Noble. You won't regret it. Buy it.
Here's how we'll delineate those. The worst guys are the ones that like the theatrical version. The best guys are the ones that like the can cut.
That's fine. That's fine.
We'll go with that.
That's fine.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Ocean's 13.
Jason, what are you like? Yeah. What are you like? Come on, man. It's Oceans.
Come
it's
on.
The Oceans movies.
It is. It is.
They
okay,
are...
but where does it fall in the trilogy for you, Roxana? This is a big question.
I mean,
this is like...
it's number three because Ocean's 12, because 12 is very good. It's better than people think it is. But like the original, like the first is still the best.
Untouchable.
Untouchable. Yes. But you know, like three is also very fun. We don't have any like women around to bother us. So like 13 is good. You know?
13 has the lamest excuse for why they're not in that movie.
It's so lame. It's just like, oh,
it's not their fight.
It's literally never been their fight, but like you drag them around anyway. Ocean 13, good.
Good. Out that same summer, Judd Apatow's Knocked Up.
I'm making a face at you, which is like a, do I really?
I know, but it's a podcast though.
Do I have to talk about this movie? I know it is a podcast. Another movie where I'm like, you could have just gotten an abortion. I mean, truly. It's so interesting to me that this was the summer of like, that this was the summer of this narrative, this sort of like, I don't even know if I really like you as a person, but like, okay, like I'll have a baby and like whatever. I don't know. Knocked Up, I think, has aged very poorly. And I'm just not a fan. I know that we did the whole like Katherine Heigl redemption narrative, and I do think we were probably too harsh on her then. But I also don't necessarily think that this movie is like all that, you know? So...
fair.
Middling, I'll say, whatever. C? Are we doing grades? C.
You can do grades. You can do it however you want.
C.
Also out that summer from producer Judd Apatow, Superbad.
Superbad, A. I still enjoy it. I still really like... A lot of good stuff in there. I really enjoy just this, like, ride or die friendship that is realizing that it's potentially no longer ride or die. And I think... yes. There is a lot of stuff there about like growing up that is still very, not necessarily relatable because like, dear God, I'm 35. I should not relate to them. But like, but that sort of sense of like realizing that something about you has to change, but not necessarily knowing what that is. I still think that's very good. And I think the humor in this movie is still... so absurd and like sort of so garish that it still works. All the dicks. There's so many dicks, right?
So many dicks.
Sometimes I just want to laugh at a dick. So, A.
Gotcha. Okay. Out later in December from producer Judd Apatow. Judd had a big 2007.
He had a really big time.
Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story.
Okay. Everybody loves Walk Hard. I sort of don't get it. Like... it's fine. People act like it's literally like the biggest send up of the biopic genre. And it's like, okay, yeah, like it's sort of low hanging fruit. Like it's not like you took on.
Okay, but Roxana, here's the thing. Here's my defense of the genius of Walk Hard.
Uh-huh.
It's not just that it's low hanging. It's that they keep making them exactly like this. Like it's a movie that somehow is satirizing movies that came out 10, 12, 15 years later. Like if you watched this after you watched Respect, you would swear that it was made in response to Respect. That's all I'm saying. I think it's right on target.
But I think to me, that almost makes it less respectable. Because I'm like, yeah, that just means that like the genre is the genre. I don't expect like Liesl Tommy, who directed Respect, to like watch Walk Hard and be like, you know what, I'm going to change my entire approach. Like, that's, you know, come on. That shit's not going to happen. So Walk Hard, B fucking minus. Like, I, you know what, whatever. I still have a little bit of my drink left.
Breach.
Pass. I don't even remember this movie. Breach?
Yeah, with Chris Cooper and Ryan Phillippe, Spy Picture.
No.
Decent movie.
I vaguely remember having a picture of Ryan Phillippe on my wall from this movie, but not actually watching this movie.
All right, fair. 310 to Yuma.
310 to Yuma. My God. Perfect. Yeah. Again, perfect. Yeah, so right? Good. Ben Foster, great. Christian Bale, great. Russell Crowe, great. That kid, was it Logan Lerman? Great. Also, I wish that the newest Thor had actually put like Bale and Crowe together in a scene, but at the same time, I actually would be really depressed if their reunion was in a Thor movie. So maybe it's better that it's not.
Yeah.
A plus.
A plus. Agreed. Waitress from the late, great Adrian Shelley.
Waitress is fine. It's funny, it came out in 07, but when I lived with one of my close friends after college in like 2010, 2011, that was in our like steady rewatch rotation. It's very comforting. Carrie Russell mm-hmm. is great. I do think that Adorbs. It's very adorable. I think it's like a perfect, like, oh, like things could be nice. Movie. Although, am I remembering correctly, who's her love interest in that?
Nathan Fillion?
Yeah, no, fuck that guy. So actually downgrade to a B+. Everybody watch The Americans, Carrie Russell's greatest work.
Edgar Wright's Hot Fuzz.
Hot Fuzz is fine. I do wish that Edgar Wright would stop like trying to say something about like humanity. Like I don't like care when he tries to do that. Like Last Night in Soho is not good.
What do you think he's trying to say about humanity in Hot Fuzz?
Oh, that's my point. I don't think he is, which is why...
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. Great. Good.
Which is why it's like enjoyable. Whereas like Last Night in Soho is like, did you know that men can be bad, but also women can be bad? I was like, oh, wow.
Yes.
Big news. Yes. Yeah, whatever.
Wes Anderson's The Darjeeling Limited.
I don't know, man. I
mean, you're making the face again.
I'm making the face. For the most part, like I am susceptible to like Wes Anderson's whole thing. Right, like
his whole thing, capital W, capital T, thing.
His whole thing. But like, I don't know, Darjeeling has like, you know, the Orientalism that like tires me, and I feel like that's actually probably the movie of his that I feel like less interested in ever rewatching. It feels the most indulgent, and given that all of his movies are indulgent, I feel like that's a particular insult. So. C+?
I feel like the short film, the standalone short film with Schwartzman and Portman, is a much more interesting piece of work than the entire feature.
100% agree. And I'm not saying that should have been a movie. I just think that it was like an interesting interlude. I do not think you need what this movie turned out to be. Now, flip side, I do really like Jason Schwartzman. So like, he is like a good nepotism baby. But
yes, he is.
But even still, I'm like, eh, whatever, it's fine.
The Savages, with our dear Philip Seymour Hoffman and Laura Linney.
You know what? I don't ever think I made it through The Savages. I know people like love this movie. I don't think I ever made it through. I feel like I found it very repellent. But now I like repellent, so maybe I should go back. What do you think, Jason?
I'd recommend the rewatch. Okay. Yes, I would.
Okay.
I think she's a very interesting filmmaker. I also loved Private Life mm-hmm. a few years back. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, all of a piece.
Okay, but what if I have very mixed feelings on Laura Linney and sometimes I find her really irritating? Is that bad?
I would tell you that it co-stars Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I know. Okay.
Sean Penn's Into the Wild.
Oh, fuck. Okay, my feelings on this are that...
Literally head in hands, listeners.
Yeah, god damn it. My feelings on this are that I don't necessarily like... I don't dislike this movie. I just think the book is so much better that it's hard for me to judge it as a film. So it's definitely one of those things where it's like, I think Krakauer's book is so good and I unexpectedly saw so much of myself in McCandless that the movie sort of separated that for me in a way that I didn't enjoy necessarily. So, like, I can understand that it's technically well made and the performances are great and, like, Kristen Stewart is very good and, like, all that jazz. But I would choose book over movie, like, every time.
That's a very nuanced take for a lightning round. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The swan song of the late, great Sidney Lumet, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
I think that's another one that I didn't watch. Isn't that also PCH? PSH?
Yes.
Okay.
Now you have a double feature.
Double feature. Yeah. There's so much Philip Seymour Hoffman. Okay. Go ahead.
Noah Baumbach's Margot at the Wedding.
No, I didn't watch that either. Look at all these like movies, all these like indie white people movies that I did not watch.
Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez's Grindhouse.
I mean, Death Proof is really, really good. Death Proof is great. It is probably, again, one of those movies that I think people watching it will say Quentin Tarantino is a misogynist. I think he's very... Okay, I'll say something. Maybe he's very good at understanding misogyny because he's a misogynist, but he still makes a compelling movie about the subject. Whereas Planet Terror, I like sort of shrugged at. Like, Planet Terror was fine, but I felt like Death Proof was actually doing something very interesting within its limitations that Planet Terror could not match.
Yeah, and sort of singular in his filmography as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Think. All right, we're going to close out the lightning round with maybe the most depressing movie on this list, and here's why.
God.
It was released on the same day as Zodiac and Black Snake Moan. Buried both of those movies at the box office. Was one of the biggest hits of the spring of 2007. I'm talking, of course, about Wild Hogs.
Oh my God. Jason, why are you doing this to me? I did not see this movie. I have no thoughts.
Good for you.
I have no thoughts. This was Tim Allen, right?
Oh, Tim Allen, John Travolta, Martin Lawrence, and William H. Macy. Beginning of William H. Macy's paycheck run, I'm afraid.
Really
yes.
Bad. The best thing that William H. Macy did was get paid well on Shameless so that Emmy Russum could eventually get paid well on Shameless. So
there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
A little solidarity there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And thus concludes our lightning round. We made it through about a half a page of the four pages of 2007 releases. But we hit the good ones, I say.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Roxanna, before we call it a night, is there anything in particular you would like to plug or any social media you'd like to send us to or any sort of closing thoughts you'd like to share?
Sure. My closing thoughts are that you should revisit all of the films I put on my list in 2007. I mean, clearly, why would you even question them?
Of course.
What I will plug is that you can find me on Twitter saying bro-y things at Roxanna, at Roxanna, R-O-X-A-N-A, underscore Haddadi, H-A-D-A-D-I. You can find my work at Vulture. I write about TV, and frequently I write about movies as well. And if you were so interested, one of the best movies of recent memory, Sound of Metal, is getting a Criterion release, and I'm very honored to be writing the essay for that. So if you had, like, you know, $20 or $40 that you were like, what should I spend this on? The clear answer is the Sound of Metal physical media release that you can buy from Criterion in September. So yeah, that's that.
I cannot wait to read that essay. I cannot wait to open a Criterion book and see my friend's byline.
Thanks, man.
Roxanna, this was a blast.
So much fun.
Thank you for being among our first batch of guests.
And I
want to go rewatch Zodiac.
It's like it's after 10 p.m. This is literally the perfect time. Go to your basement or your darkest room. Turn out all the lights and just like be horrified for 2.5 hours. It's the best way to live.
It is, as we say, big Zodiac hours.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening.
It was a very good